You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. This segment is sponsored by Ducks Unlimited. Join the thousands of volunteers having fun more than 3,500 times a year. Get involved at www.volunteerfordu.org.
Hey everybody, welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. I am Rob Dreeslein. Thanks so much for tuning in. We're here every week on this station. We have a good time talking outdoor topics. We're going to talk a little bit about Pheasant Fest, which is coming up here in just a couple of weeks. Then we're going to talk owls a little bit later with someone from the International Owl Center down in Houston, Minnesota. And then Tim Lesmeister is going to help me wrap up this week's show. With that, let's jump in with my first guest. I haven't had him on in a long time. I'm excited to chat with him a little bit, catch up. It's Jared Wicklund, Director of Communications for St. Paul-based Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. Jared, good to see you, my man. How's it going?
Hey Rob, good to see you too. Good to hear your voice. It's going great. We're into winter here. The winter hasn't been too bad yet for pheasants and other wildlife. It looks like we got some nice weather. Maybe the 10-day forecast. I think we're in about the 30s just about every day here over the next 10. At least that's what I'm seeing.
After being below average for quite a while, maybe we're going to be at least average, maybe a little bit better, which we will definitely take, because that was a pretty tough cold spell. Before we talk about your big event coming up here later this month, let's recap the pheasant season. Everybody pretty happy. It sounded like pretty good pheasant hunting across the rooster range, the rooster belt.
It was. I don't want to steal a South Dakota term, but when people ask me, I've been doing plenty of radio shows and stuff lately, and when people ask me like, hey, how was your pheasant season? I think the word I would use is legendary, honestly. We didn't know exactly what to expect with the spring weather that we had this year going into nesting season, but we were coming off of two good winters in a row. And sort of those late nesters, I think happened once again after we got some rain during the nesting season. And most of the states in the upper Midwest, upper Great Plains here saw pretty nice increases for pheasants and for quail, if you're into the bobwhite quail species. But yeah, it was a really good, I know my own travels across pheasant country. I was in South Dakota this year, hunted Minnesota, obviously. That's about as far as I got for pheasants. But anecdotally, from chapter members and, used to work down in Iowa, still have a lot of contacts down there. It was their 100th anniversary of the pheasant season. It was spectacular. So I'm hopeful that we're set up for another good year here. But as everybody knows, the end of winter, those late spring snowstorms can really deliver a hit to pheasants if it comes at the wrong time. So we'll see what happens. But right now, I think it's been good.
It's all, yeah, weather dependent. And there's some snow across the range, and you know, having a little water out there isn't necessarily bad, right, for spring. Get the plant life going, get the pollinators going, and the insects going, which is good for pheasants, right? So
yeah, I think, you know, a lot of times there's that fine balance, right? Especially as you go further west in the pheasant range and it gets arid, you got to have that moisture there. So I'm talking with ranchers lately, you know, like out near the Missouri River in South Dakota and other places, they're thankful for the moisture that we've had.
Well, let's talk about the big event coming. Gosh, I don't know. It's been at least 20 years, I think, since the first Pheasant Fest hit here in Minneapolis. And that annual event has been a real big success for Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. It travels every year, right?
It does.
It's either here in Minneapolis or out in Sioux Falls, or every third year you take it to a different city. Where was it last year? Remind me.
Kansas City.
Okay. Yep. So that means next year it'll be in Sioux Falls.
Possibly. We're not going to give it away quite yet, but we do a pretty big circuit. We've been to Madison. We've been to Schaumburg, Twin Cities, obviously, Sioux Falls, Omaha, Kansas City, Des Moines. So we're looking at a lot of different options right now, but we always love coming back to Minnesota. This is sort of our home turf where Pheasants Sure. Forever was born and raised. When you look at Minnesota as an outdoor destination, it's second to none. I mean, we've just got awesome resources.
So, Jared, you are back in Minneapolis, Minneapolis Convention Center, February 20th to 22nd. That's a Friday through Sunday. Three big days. Kicks off again with the old Bird Dog Parade, correct?
It does, yeah. Bird Dog Parade. We haven't even really marketed the event yet as far as the Bird Dog Parade is concerned, and we've got 100 dogs and 36 breeds signed up right now. So it's always a big spectacle to kick off National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic. And our good friend Bob St. Pierre is up on the mic along with Carl Gunzer from Purina, just talking about all the different sizes and shapes that bird dogs come in. So it's always fun.
Yeah, he wears the good old blaze orange sport coat, if memory
serves. He does. The crowd loves it.
So like we say, it comes back to Minneapolis every 3 years. It started here. Yeah, what year did Pheasant Fest start? Do you
I believe it was 2003.
Okay, that sounds about right. I think it was down in Bloomington that first year, and everybody was just kind of shocked at how successful it was. And of course it's grown since then, and as you mentioned, it's traveled. There's a couple big banquets that occur with this, right? There's the what do you call it, the national
Upland
dinner.
Yep, we got the Upland Rally on Friday night. There's still a few tickets available for that. The Saturday night National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic Saturday night dinner, I think there's maybe like 25 tickets left. It's almost sold out. I'm actually really excited for that. This year, we've got Dennis Anderson, who you and I know extremely well, and I think a lot of Minnesotans know, as the founder of Pheasants Forever. He's going to be telling the founding story, and really excited to hear some of the stories that he's going to offer up. He actually called me from the Bahamas the other day, and I asked him how his speech was coming, and he replied, "Well, that's why I was calling you." Just chuckled a little bit, but he's got some things up his sleeve, and I think people are going to enjoy a really fun story from Dennis on Saturday night.
Pheasantsforever.org is the website, and your organization refers to itself as the Habitat Organization, right? You're all about upland bird habitat. That's been the point of the organization going back to 1982.
Yeah, wildlife habitat conservation is the name of the business. I mean, we try to, right now we're focused on how do we put more boots on the ground to put more birds on the ground. But obviously the byproduct of that is everything I think most Americans care about. So it's clean water, pollinators, good soil. There's a lot of different benefits that come from focusing on pheasant and quail habitat with Quail Forever. Anytime, I don't know if you want to call them a keystone species, but when we're putting quality upland habitat on the landscape, all those different critters benefit.
You listen to Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Jerisa, and we're chatting with Jared Wicklund, Director of Communications for St. Paul-based Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. The organization's got its big annual event, Pheasant Fest, coming to the Minneapolis Convention Center February 20th to 22nd. You can get all the details on this event at pheasantfest.org, or you can link to it through pheasantsforever.org also. There's a concert for conservation. Still some tickets available for that?
We're down to less than 100 tickets out of 2,100. We're extremely excited. This is the third year. Turnpike Troubadours is here this year, and we've got Dave Simonette, who's the lead man for Trampled by Turtles, opening for Turnpike. So really excited about it. At the State Theater, doors open at 6 o'clock, I believe. The concert starts at 7:30 at the State Theater on February 19th. I'll be down there working the merchandise booth. So if you have tickets, stop by and say hi and grab a poster and help us raise some money for wildlife habitat conservation efforts.
Quick tip of the hat to Dave Simonette, who's been an awesome supporter of Pheasants Forever and conservation in general. Man, I don't know how much money he's raised for PF and Sportsman for the Boundary Waters and other groups, but I'm sure it's a big number, and we appreciate his dedication to outdoor causes.
Absolutely.
Great guy. If you go to pheasantfest.org, you're going to see a list of all the different seminars at this event. You've got, what, four or five seminar stages? Tell us about what folks might be able to see there.
Yeah, I think we got five different stages this year. So it's nice that Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic, it's sort of a, you can call it a trade show, but it's paired with a seminar series. So if you want to come and learn about bird dogs or public land habitat or just habitat in general, we've got all those different things. So Public Land Pavilion pays homage to the country's 800 million acres of public accessible lands. If you want to learn about trips that you can go on, we've got some experts that are going to be up on stage talking about those things. The bird dog stage obviously is our largest attraction of the show. It always has been. Just great trainers and vets with timely information about how to keep your bird dog healthy throughout the year, training tips. Path to the Uplands, if you're new to getting into upland hunting, or maybe you're reactivated and we're just trying to find your way, we've got all sorts of resources on that stage as well. The Habitat stage is always a big part of what we do, obviously, as the Habitat organization. We've also got the Habitat Help Area. If you're interested in coming up with a conservation plan on the spot for your property, we have that as well. And for the kids, we've got a huge youth area this year. I think we've got like 26 volunteers signed up to run that area. But if you want to come over and try out some BB guns or shoot some bow and arrows or do a habitat project, there's a lot of things available for the kids to do as well.
You were telling me off air there's an opportunity to get access to some free tickets. If folks just go to pheasantfest.org and click admission passes, there's a little comp code for them.
Yep. Like you just said, pheasantfest.org, click on admission passes. And when you check out, if you type in the code COMP, as in complimentary, COMP, all capital letters, 26, you can get up to four free tickets for National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic. And that's just our way of thanking Minnesotans for coming out and living the outdoor lifestyle and supporting wildlife habitat conservation, which Minnesota, we just have such a, and we're going to be talking about that on multiple stages, but Minnesota just has such a wonderful funding mechanism for the outdoors. It's something that I think a lot of us cherish here in the state, and it's what makes us a top five pheasant hunting destination as well.
And like we were saying, special events for women and kids. It's all there at pheasantfest.org. Check it out. It's a great event. I'm looking forward to being down there and seeing you. Jared's seeing you and all the staff. It's been a great party. I really love every 3 years when it rolls through the Twin Cities, and I'm looking forward to a great event again here in 2026.
Yeah, we're looking forward to having you, and I think it's going to be a celebration of all things upland and bird dogs, so come on out. It's the best gathering of the year for me because I get to see friends new and old and talk bird dogs and talk hunting, and we always seem to come up with an awesome trip out of it at some sort throughout pheasant and quail and grouse countries.
February 20th to 22nd at the Minneapolis Convention Center. It's the annual Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic. Check it all out at pheasantfest.org. Jared, thanks a lot for joining me. Have a good show, and we'll see you there.
Thanks, Rob. Look forward to seeing you.
Let's break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Since 1937, Ducks Unlimited has been dedicated to conserving waterfowl habitat, from breeding grounds and migration routes to southern wintering areas. Thanks to the efforts of our volunteers and supporters, we've conserved millions of acres. However, our work is far from over. You can be part of our next million-acre year. Visit ducks.org/volunteer to join the team making a real difference. Ducks Unlimited, conservation for a continent.
By the numbers, here are the costs of not having Onyx fish. 400 extra holes drilled, 100 wasted ice miles, 20 needless gallons of truck, snowmobile, or ATV gas, 5 trips trying to catch a walleye where they don't live, 3 days of vacation you'll never get back, 2 wrong turns that cost you an extra hour at prime time, and 1 last time you'll waste dollars and effort. Onyx Fish, $34.99 per year, 10 Midwest states, countless ways to catch more fish.
Pheasants Forever's National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic is coming to the Minneapolis Convention Center on the weekend of February 20th. Join us for puppy and dog training seminars, a youth village for kids, hunting seminars and gear, and more than 400 exhibitors. It's National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic, the weekend of February 20th, presented by Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, and Federal Ammunition. For more information, log on to pheasantfest.org.
Smokey the Bear.
Then you know why Smokey tells you when he sees you passing through. Remember, please be careful, it's the least that you can do.
This is what you desire, don't play with matches, don't play with fire. After 80 years of learning his wildfire prevention tips, Smokey Bear lives within us all. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com. And remember,
only you can prevent wildfires.
Brought to you by the USDA Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Ice season is here, and when you pull your favorite fish up through the ice, make sure you finish it right. Chef Robert's Gourmet Breading Mix was created by a chef over 40 years ago who just wanted a better fish fry. Today, it's the same great flavor in a resealable 12-ounce bag. Perfect for your kitchen or the hot stove out on the ice. Three flavors, original lemon, pepper, and Cajun. Just wet the fish, coat it, and cook it. That's it. One step from hole to plate. Chef Robert's, when you catch your favorite fish, use your favorite breading. Visit www.chefroberts.com for more information.
Unleash the power of the Onyx Hunt app this turkey season and see how it'll become one of the best tools in your turkey vest. Use color-coded public and private land ownership information, tree species, and crop layers to scout from the comfort of your home. Then hit the field using compass mode, waypoints, and multiple base maps to help pin down more gobblers this spring. Use promo code ODN20 to receive 20% off your membership at onyxmaps.com/hunt.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreisline with you for another segment. Thanks so much for tuning in. Hope you like the content here. If so, check us out online at outdoornews.com, or you can also call us at 800-535-5191. It's kind of that time of year. We're into February already. There's not a lot going on. I've talked a little bit about squirrel and rabbit hunting. And of course, we've got good ice fishing. Inland Waters walleye continues for a few more weeks. But it's a fun time of year to talk maybe a non-game topic. And one that always I think about in the middle of winter are owls. I hear them a lot this time of year. So I thought this would be a good chance to check in with someone from the International Owl Center down in Houston, Minnesota. I have visited that facility. It's not too far from where my parents live. It's a great little operation that they've got going down there. And Carla Bloom, the executive director of the International Owl Center, joins us now. Carla, it's good to see you. I've never interviewed you before. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks.
Tell us briefly about the International Owl Center. How long has it been around?
The International Owl Center itself formally has been around since 2015, so 11 years now. Many people think it's been here a lot longer since I started doing owl education programs with Alice the Great Horned Owl back in 1998, and we started the Houston Nature Center in 2001, and we started the International Festival of Owls in 2003. So the Owl Center is kind of an outgrowth of all that other owl activity.
Why is Houston, Minnesota the epicenter, ground zero for owls internationally? Why Houston, Minnesota?
That's the question we get asked every single day. Houston's less than 1,000 people. Why on earth would you put it here? And it's because we never intended to do an International Owl Center. It just evolved here. I mean, I was just doing owl programs with Alice, and we started a hatch day party for her that turned into the International Festival of Owls and got out of hand. And then we realized there was no all owl education center anywhere in the United States. So we decided to do that.
Yeah. And you're right on Main Street. Is that correct? In Houston?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Not where you would expect us. We're in the old historic Skifton department store right in downtown Houston, which is not an ideal location, but it's a good place to get started.
But you are raising money to try to build, and you've got land, but to build a larger facility, correct?
Right. Ever since we started, the goal was always to have our own facility in a park at the edge of town. So right next to Trailhead Park, where the Root River Trail comes into town, just south of the Root River, we own 4.5 acres free and clear there. We've removed all the buildings, and now we're just raising funds so that we can build what we actually should have for an owl center.
How many owls do you have in the facility that people can see and watch during some of the programming?
There are 5 that currently come to work right now. We have 2 retired ladies. Alice, the Great Horned Owl, is still with us. She's turning 29 this festival, but she's got arthritis, cataracts, atherosclerosis. And then Iris, the Great Horned Owl, is retired from our breeding program, but she still streams live to our YouTube channel. And then our other 5, we have a Great Horned, a Bard, an Eastern Screech, an American Barn Owl, and a Burrowing Owl come to work.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, I've been there a couple times. I brought my daughter. She always loves when we've gone to watch some of the seminars there. We'll circle back to the Owl Center before we're done, Carla, but let's talk about the owls that we have in Minnesota. And I was thinking about this before we spoke. We've got a really good cross-section for all of the North American owls in the state of Minnesota. We've got
a lot of we don't, I guess, have the deep south owls, but a lot of the, you know, the northern owls, the Borley owls, the hawk owls, they'll come down in the winter. Minnesota's a pretty good state to see a wild owl, isn't it?
Everybody knows Minnesota for great gray owls, hawk owls, boreal owls, and snowy owls. Those northern ones are sort of our specialty in the northern part of the state.
But we've got great horns. We've got barred owls. We've got screech owls. We've got saw-whets. Are there even a few? Historically, there were probably burrowing owls in western Minnesota, weren't there? Are there any now? Any here now?
Burrowing owls are Minnesota's only endangered owl species.
Okay.
They were traditionally in the western part of the state in pastures. They need short grass, and they have to have something making a burrow for them. So that typically would have been a badger. And there's not that many badgers, and there's not that many pastures anymore. And they're pretty much declining across their whole entire range. Mm. So they do occasionally show up in Minnesota. But yeah, they are endangered.
South Dakota, western South Dakota, great place to see a burrowing owl.
Wherever there's prairie dogs are usually good places.
Sure. There's a few burrowing owls down in Florida, aren't there?
Yeah. Burrowing owls are in the western part of the United States. And then there's this population in Florida that's totally disjunct from all the other ones.
That's
wild. They're, yeah, genetically somewhat different. You can get some eye variations in there. But yeah, so there's a Burrowing Owl Festival in Cape Coral that started the same year as our Festival of Owls.
You're listening to Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Jerisa, and we are chatting with Carla Bloom. She's the executive director of the International Owl Center down in Houston, Minnesota. They got their big Festival of Owls coming up in March. We'll talk some more about that later. When folks are sitting around at night and they hear an owl hooting in the suburbs, like where I live, what are they probably hearing, Carla? What owls are most active this time of year?
Well, great horned owls are getting into nesting. Some are actually on eggs already. So late January, early February is when great horns are typically laying eggs, and they get hooty before they lay eggs. Now, once they've laid eggs, then they stop talking as much. So great horns you can identify because they've got that low, mellow, who's awake, me too. So the male is a hoo, 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 and the female's a little higher, a few more notes, hoo, 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 hoo. You can identify owl species just by their calls. So very often people say, I hear owls, but I don't know which ones they are. So if you learn the calls, you can tell what owl you have at your place, even if you're not seeing it.
And can you hear some of those different owl calls just at the International Owl Center website, internationalowlcenter.org?
We have a boatload of great horned owl websites. If you go into the research section of our website, because I actually found out when I got Alice that nobody had studied their vocalizations. So I've been doing a vocal study on great horned owls for over 20 years now, I guess. So we have a long list of those and then a smattering of other ones.
What's with great horned owls nesting so early? What's the evolutionary adaptation for that, the advantage for nesting? It's just because they're so huge. They're big animals.
They're big, so they develop a little bit slower, and the kids have to be independent by fall, so you got to get them going. It takes a while for them to grow. They're 6 to 8 weeks before they fledge, and then you got to time that with a good food supply, and then the kids have to get good enough at hunting on their own so they can be independent, hopefully by fall, although you get some kids that'll mooch from their parents until the next breeding season. That's rare, but sometimes they do.
I hear a fair number of barred owls, too, this time of year.
Yep. If you are in a place that's got large trees, especially if you're near water, you're probably going to have barred owls. And they are very chatty, and they do the traditional who cooks for you, who cooks for you, that turkey hunters use to put the turkeys to bed.
Yep,
so they
yep.
do that. You can tell male from female. Male is a little lower with a shorter awl, and the female is higher with a longer awl. So the male is more, oh, 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 and the right. female is, oh, oh.
Wow, you've got that dialed in, Carla. Nicely done.
I learned from owls directly.
Your life is owls, yeah, and you've clearly got that, as I said, dialed in. Other species of owls that we have here, what are some of our other most common resident owls that folks might see or hear?
So where we are in the southeastern part of the state, screech owls are going to be a regular, and they do not screech. Everybody assumes they screech. They do a whinny that sounds like a little horse up in a tree. So it's kind of a.
I bet a lot of people have heard that sound. Yeah. Okay.
And then they also do a trill that they like to put in the background of scary movies. Kind of a.
Okay. We've got other species, long-eared owls, short-eared owls. You were telling me, my dad sends a lot of trail cam pictures to me, and sometimes they don't always resonate with me. But you said he had a shot of a barn owl. Those are pretty rare, aren't they? Are they threatened in some parts of the country?
Barn owls kind of used to be in the upper Midwest and the northeastern U.S. until maybe the mid-60s, and then they kind of disappeared. They're strong all in the warmer climates because they're not built for cold weather. So California, Texas, Florida, boatloads of barn owls. But in the colder places here, they kind of disappeared, but now they're starting to show up again.
Huh.
So inadvertently, I wound up doing barn owl research acoustically because I was doing acoustic research, and they started showing up on our recording equipment, kept getting barn owl calls. So then I got automated recording units that I could put in other locations and started picking them up in other places. But they don't talk much. They're very strictly nocturnal, and they're very good at staying away from people. But your dad sent a picture of a barn owl at, I think, a water feature that he had on a trail cam. So that was great to have photo evidence of that also, which is much less common.
Why do we think barn owls are maybe coming back?
So one theory, of course, is climate change. If it's getting warmer here, then it's easier for them to survive. But we've had some pretty horrendously cold winters that they've been getting through. Barn owls are very different from other owls. They're like the rabbits of the owl world. They're into production, not maintenance. So you make boatloads of babies. Huh. They disperse wildly, like 1,000 kilometers is not unusual for a barn owl to travel huge distances, but very high mortality. And they can reproduce even here twice a year. So you can have spring brood and fall brood, unlike any of the other owl species that we have here.
Has this been much of an eruption year where we see more northern owls in the northern part of the state? I understand you're in the southeast. Have we seen many snowy owls, hawk owls, boreal owls in 2026?
I don't go up there myself because I'm busy planning the owl festival down here, so I don't have much time to get up there. But it doesn't seem like it's been a huge eruption year. Okay. There were kind of a bunch of snowies that came at the beginning, and people got excited, and then there wasn't quite as much after that. I'm not hearing a ton about great grays or hawk owls or boreals.
Before we go, let's talk about your Festival of Owls. That's in March?
March 6th to the 8th. So it's always the first weekend of March every year.
All right. So just a month out, what will be happening down at your facility during the festival?
Pretty much everything you could imagine relating to owls and then some. So we bring in the Illinois Raptor Center with their live owls in addition to our owls, and they bring a live snowy owl. So that's a really big hit. The Boy Scouts do owl nest box building. We do pellet dissection. We do bus trips to call in wild owls. We have a kids owl calling contest because adults are too chicken to do it. So the kids get up front and imitate owl calls, and we award prizes. So we have some of the top owl people in the world coming. This year we have Marianne Savelsberg, who studies Eurasian eagle owl vocalizations in the Netherlands, will be coming to speak. And then if you heard about Flacco, the Eurasian eagle owl set free from the Central Park Zoo a few years ago in New York City, that guy was in the news.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
So Flacco is posthumously, if you can say that, receiving an award. And David Lynn and Jackie Emery, two of the people that followed him closely and wrote a magnificent book about him, will be doing a presentation about Flacco at the festival.
Right. Well, it sounds like a very full schedule. It's all at internationalowlcenter.org if folks want all the details. You said March 6th to 8th?
Yeah, actually, the event is so big, it's got its own website. So you can get directed there from the Owl Center website, but it's festivalofowls.com.
Festivalofowls.com. Very easy to remember. Carla, thanks so much for spending a segment with me. Congratulations on the success down there. Like I said, I visited the facility a couple times. It's wonderful. You got great staff. That's a real coup for the city of Houston to have the International Owl Center. And looking forward to getting down there again and visiting you folks.
All right. Thanks for having us.
Festivalofowls.com or internationalowlcenter.org for more details. Thank you to Carla Bloom, who joined us for a segment here. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Whatever you're hunting, be it small game, predators, gobblers, or big game, Henry Repeating Arms has a rifle or shotgun you can trust. With over 200 models to choose from, every Henry is proudly made in Wisconsin, backed by a lifetime warranty and supported by top customer service. From the squirrel woods to deer camp, there's a Henry for your hunt. Order your free Henry catalog today at henryusa.com. You'll also get a sheet of decals, the Henry Repeater newsletter, and a personalized list of local dealers. That's henryusa.com. Get your free catalog today and gear up for the season.
You fish the same waters year after year. But what if your next best fishing story is just a few miles away? Onyx Fish builds on 15 years of experience, giving hunters and adventurers a revolutionary angling tool to help you find new water, new access, and new fish. Find the right lake. Know the species, size, and abundance. Get expert local insight. Navigate to the right ramp fast. Then go fish in new lakes like they're your home waters. Don't chase reports. Make your own with Onyx Fish.
Is a trip to Alaska on your bucket list? It's time to dump that bucket and buy your ticket. And while you're there, fish the Kenai River with Jason's Guide Service. Jason is considered the best when it comes to catching Alaskan salmon, rainbow trout, and char. He's one of only a few guides that has the permit to fish in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, where the salmon are easy targets and the trout and char are plentiful. So cross that Alaskan fishing trip off your list and check out jasonsguideservice.com. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
The Outdoor News Foundation is dedicated to nurturing the next generation of outdoor enthusiasts. Through your generous donations, we provide youth with access to OutdoorNews.com, educational scholarships, and grants. Every dollar donated goes directly to connecting young people with nature and outdoor activities. Help us cast a legacy for the next generation of outdoor enthusiasts and conservation leaders. Visit OutdoorNews.com to get involved, learn more, and donate today.
Ice season is here, and when you pull your favorite fish up through the ice, make sure you finish it right. Chef Robert's Gourmet Breading Mix was created by a chef over 40 years ago who just wanted a better fish fry. Today, it's the same great flavor in a resealable 12-ounce bag, perfect for your kitchen or the hot stove out on the ice. Three flavors, original lemon, pepper, and Cajun. Just wet the fish, coat it, and cook it. That's it. One step from hole to plate. Chef Robert's, when you catch your favorite fish, use your favorite breading. Visit www.chefroberts.com for more information.
Have more success on the ice with the LiveScope Plus Ice Fishing Bundle LI from Garmin. Drill fewer holes, catch more fish. This portable live sonar bundle comes with the LiveScope Plus system, EchoMap UHD 93SV display, and a lithium battery. All packaged in a case, making hole hopping a breeze. LiveScope Plus helps you find more fish with improved resolution, reduced noise, clearer images, and better target separation. Fill your freezer with fillets with help from Garmin. Visit Garmin.com or shop your local Garmin dealer today.
Welcome back, everybody. Outdoor News Radio, back half of this week's broadcast. Tim Lesmeister joining us. Thank you for tuning in. If you like what we chat about here, check us out online at OutdoorNews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. We'd love to get you a subscription to our print or digital versions. Tim, welcome. Before we get too deep here, I see I got a press release from the DNR. Good reminder. If folks want to apply for turkey permits in two wildlife management areas, Carlos Avery and Whitewater, for the A season only, they need to apply by February 13th. All the rest of the tags are over the counter these days, but those two WMAs are pretty popular, especially for that early season, and so the DNR does still make you apply if you want to get a permit for those two chunks of public land.
Well, a lot of the hunters know that those both are areas that have high concentrations of turkeys, and that's why they do get a lot of hunting pressure. So you got to do permits in a situation like that. Otherwise, you'd be tripping over people trying to get to the spot where you were going to start calling, and you'd be sitting in the middle of your spot, and you'd be thinking there were toms everywhere, and it'd turn out there was just people gobbling and trying to get other gobblers to come to them.
Yeah, one is very close to the metro area, North Metro, and the other is just this huge, gorgeous piece of public land in the heart of turkey country in southeastern Minnesota. You know, I would point out to folks, the A season is, what, 5-7 days long, and then B season starts, and from then on out, you don't need a permit. So you can go and hunt those public lands you need a permit, but you can buy it over the counter. You don't need to apply for it. So I guess the rest of the turkey tags go on sale in March. Again, it's over the counter. It's unlimited. So if you don't buy it in early March, you can wait until early April before the season starts to buy your tag.
You know, watching the evolution of the turkey population expansion and how the hunters took to it, it makes you realize just how popular a sport can get when there's enough of a reward. And in this case, you know, when grouse populations are up, we see a lot more people buying hunting licenses so they can go hunt grouse. Same with pheasant. And now we see that with turkeys too. I mean, it's gotten to the point now where the number of turkey hunters in Minnesota is quite substantial. And the reason for that is because, you know, there's a lot of turkeys out there to hunt. I think it's wonderful. I'm seeing turkeys I'm seeing turkeys so far north here. It just boggles my mind.
Yeah, they definitely filled a niche. And we're not too far out. We're a couple months away, hard to believe, from turkey hunting 2026. This is Rob Dreeslein with Tim Lesmeister, having a good time here as usual. I wrote my column, Tim, about this tab plan, vehicle tabs. The DNR issued a report back in mid-January, kind of examining how other states have implemented a system where folks can buy state park stickers when they buy their vehicle tabs. There's been some good success in other states, and our DNR is convinced it's going to generate more income for state parks and then maybe some other public lands. I don't know. I think they're being a little optimistic, but nonetheless, I think it's probably it's a low risk kind of thing to implement, and I think it's probably worth trying here in Minnesota.
Absolutely. I think this is a great model. I see it in Michigan, where the Michigan State Park stickers have gone up dramatically because people have been buying them along with their license tabs. But one of the things that I don't understand about these state organizations having these great state parks is that sometimes it's the same old, same old. They get, let's get the kids in here on the weekend and we'll take them for a walk around the woods and we'll show them what the trees are what and stuff like that. And one of the things I like about Michigan is that they do some things in their state parks that really pull the people in. In August, I go to the Porcupine Mountain Music Festival that's held at one of the Michigan state parks. I buy a park sticker to do that. And I think that if the state of Minnesota wants to get more people to their parks, they're going to have to start thinking out of the box, because they're dealing with a whole different, group of individuals now, these younger people that want to go to these parks, not just to hang out with nature, but maybe to do some other stuff too. So start thinking about it. You've got a model now to sell these park stickers with license tabs. Now give people a reason to buy them and come there to utilize that property.
Yeah, programming at state and national parks is really key. It's really important. Some of my best memories with my kids when they were younger is being in national parks and attending, the ranger talks at night. And that gets into a whole other issue, the way the Trump administration has eviscerated the national park budget and its staff, which I think is absolutely terrible. I've been pretty clear about that on this program. And I hope we find funding for state parks, and I hope the feds get their act together not just the feds, the Trump administration gets its act together and realizes how important things like national park funding are to our national identity. But speaking of the national level, we had a little item. I don't know if you saw it, Tim. The Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, an organization I think very highly of, looks like they've gone through yet another executive director. Joel Peterson has been at that job for about 18 months. He replaced Whit Fosberg, who had been in the job for about 10 years prior to that. It looks like one of their board chairs, a guy named Matt Cook, is going to jump in. We've seen this with some other organizations too. Backcountry Hunters and Anglers has gone through, Land Tawney left a couple of years ago, and the interim guy there didn't last very long. Now they've got Cal Callahan running that organization. Well, what's going on? Why can't these big conservation nonprofits hold a CEO for very long?
Because there's a lot of work involved. I could be wrong. I probably am. I look at those jobs and I think to myself, oh my gosh, could I handle something like that? Not in a million years. You need to get somebody in there that's really dedicated, but is willing to put in the time. And those kind of people, they're hard to find.
Yeah, I think the work is probably part of it. I mean, I know about work myself. I wonder if the fundraising is part of it. If these guys, huge part of their job is being on the phone, finding donors, grants, that sort of thing. And if that tends to wear somebody out, they get into the role and realize, oh, all I'm doing is fundraising and, I'm not doing enough conservation work. I'm going to move on. I don't know. That's just a theory.
Well, a lot of this stuff is handled by grants as well. These organizations live and die by grants. And you were just mentioned earlier how, the feds now these days are cutting grants in every direction. And so we're looking at a situation where they may have to start making phone calls and trying to raise money using other methods. And that could definitely put a kink in the armor for the individual that wants to, like you said, just spend more time out there doing what they were hired to do.
Yeah, I didn't know Joel Peterson very well, but I guess good luck to him. We'll see how this Matt Cook does. He's the interim head. Becky Humphreys was the interim chair there for a while too before they hired Peterson. But that's been a really important group, TRCP. Whit Fosberg did a great job with that organization. They were really key in moving the needle on some conservation issues. We need that the organization to be vibrant. Tim, you'll stick around. We'll talk some fishing.
Absolutely.
All right, don't go away. More Outdoor News Radio after these messages.
Pheasants Forever's National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic is coming to the Minneapolis Convention Center on the weekend of February 20th. Join us for puppy and dog training seminars, a youth village for kids, hunting seminars and gear, and more than 400 exhibitors. It's National Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic, the weekend of February 20th, presented by Pheasants Forever, Quail Forever, and Federal Ammunition. For more information, log on to pheasantfest.org.
By the numbers, here are the costs of not having Onyx fish. 400 extra holes drilled, 100 wasted ice miles, 20 needless gallons of truck, snowmobile, or ATV gas, 5 trips trying to catch a walleye where they don't live, 3 days of vacation you'll never get back, 2 wrong turns that cost you an extra hour at prime time, and 1 last time you'll waste dollars and effort. Onyx Fish, $34.99 per year, 10 Midwest states, countless ways to catch more fish.
Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, a nationwide group working to keep public lands in public hands so future generations can enjoy what we enjoy. Join the group that makes a difference. Check us out at backcountryhunters.org.
Are you ready to hit the frozen waters and reel in some epic catches? The all-new OutdoorNews.com is your ultimate resource for all things ice fishing. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, OutdoorNews.com is the source for the latest tips, techniques, and gear reviews. Stay ahead of the rest with the most up-to-date ice conditions, fishing reports, and hotspots to maximize your success. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity to elevate your hard water game. Visit OutdoorNews.com today and become part of the ice angling revolution.
Hey, Steve Panaz here. For too long, Minnesota anglers have not had a strong voice at the legislature or the DNR. You can help ensure the quality of state fisheries by joining the MinFish Sport Fishing Foundation. Individual memberships are free and life memberships are available. MinFish Foundation is dedicated to restoring, protecting, and enhancing Minnesota's sport fishing opportunities. To join us, visit min-fish.com.
Whatever you're hunting, be it small game, predators, gobblers, or big game, Henry Repeating Arms has a rifle or shotgun you can trust. With over 200 models to choose from, every Henry is proudly made in Wisconsin, backed by a lifetime warranty and supported by top customer service. From the Squirrel Woods to Deer Camp, there's a Henry for your hunt. Order your free Henry catalog today at henryusa.com. You'll also get a sheet of decals, the Henry Repeater newsletter, and a personalized list of local dealers. That's henryusa.com. Get your free catalog today and gear up for the season.
As farmers and ranchers, stewardship of the land comes naturally. You help keep water clean, improve the soil, and provide habitat for wildlife. But did you know conservation can also improve your bottom line? Learn more at conservationpays.org.
Everybody, welcome back. Outdoor News Radio. Rob Driesline with you for our final segment, along with Tim Lesmeister. You can read what we've got cooking at OutdoorNews.com, or you can also subscribe to the print version. Call us at 800-535-5191 if you want to subscribe to print or digital, or again, you can do that at OutdoorNews.com. Tim, we've got some fishing topics we should tackle, starting with Lake Mille Lacs. They went and altered the perch limit up there again.
About time. Geez, you know, people used to go up there and fill buckets full of perch. I can remember the days when you'd go up there to walleye fish and these big perch would move in and people would just start loading up their buckets. And then they realized, hey, you know, these fish are going to get fished out is what I guess a term you could use to describe what was going on there. And so they started putting limits on them, and the limit just keeps dropping and dropping and dropping as this fish got to be very popular and anglers just started becoming more and more adept.
What have they been doing, Tim? Tell me what they've been doing, Tim.
Over harvesting.
They've been using forward facing sonar. Is what they've been doing. I don't know why no one wants to say
it. I knew
it
that's
aloud.
What you were getting at.
I don't know why I'm the only one who wants to say it. But anyway, I think this is the fourth perch limit on the lake in what, 12, 13 months.
Yeah, it's true.
It was 20 a year ago, which is the statewide limit. They blew the lid off the quota last year. They dropped it to 5. Then, you know, there wasn't a lot of harvest, right, during the summer. So they decided to,
increase the limit a little bit and go with 10 starting on December 1. And yeah, I mean, what are we, just a little over 2 months after they implemented that reg? They said anglers are blowing the lid off it again. And this is after kind of a slow start. They didn't have great ice conditions there. So, you know, anglers weren't really pounding it too hard. But it sounds like since early to mid-January, it really has amped up. And so they're knocking it back to five again. And I asked Brian Nairbone, the regional fisheries guy, you know, is it possible you would shut it off? And he said, well, you know, all options are on the table. Brad Parsons, DNR fisheries chief last year, told me that they need to abide by and respect the state's quota for perch, even though the bands don't take anywhere near their quota. It would seem like perch population isn't in trouble. If there's like roughly, what, a 72,000, 73,000 pound total quota, and the combined harvest between the state and the bands is, you know, 50,000 some, well, okay, the population's okay, but nonetheless, the state always goes out of its way to abide by its quota. And so it's not out of the question, you know, that we could close down perch fishing on Mille Lacs later this winter. I don't think that's going to happen. I hope that doesn't happen, but DNR saying every option's on the table.
You are absolutely correct that fish that suspend, like perch, walleyes, they're out in basically open water in areas that aren't not a lot of cover. They're definitely susceptible to the forward-facing sonar, or any kind of sonar, really, but the forward-facing sonar will definitely get you onto these fish. If you're off 35, 40 yards, you'll pick them up, and you can go drill holes in that general vicinity and find them pretty easily. So they're also pretty easy to pattern. I mean, the nice thing about perch is you can send down a camera, and they'll literally swim up and surround the camera. It actually kind of holds them in place when you put that big black camera down the hole. And then you can watch them and see what it is that you need to do to trigger that bite. And so finding and catching perch is fairly easy. And on Mille Lacs, it's a piece of cake. So, yeah, I can see why they want to restrict it. Because, you know, with the really restricted walleye limits on Mille Lacs, perch are the next best thing.
Well, I mean, they do have a three-fish walleye bag right now on Mille Lacs. So, I mean, that's the silver lining, is that you can still go to Mille Lacs and catch some walleyes. And you still take, you know, you go up there with your kid, you can still bring home 10 nice jumbo perch. We had a big jumbo perch on the front cover from Mille Lacs. So, I mean, it's good news. It's fun. I'm glad people are going up there and catching a lot of fish and having a good time. But nonetheless, the DNR is watching it close and deciding that, hey, we've got a limit harvest. And you know, this circles back to, as technology improves, the only lever the DNR has is limits. And I definitely think the perch limit on Mille Lacs is exhibit A in the grand debate over forward-facing sonar and some of this other technology. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Zerisine and Tim Lesmeister bringing home this week's broadcast. We also had a story, I actually dropped it into the paper last minute this week, Tim, about rough fish limits. The DNR deciding that it wants to implement some limits on rough fish. We're now calling them native rough fish, and that's, I guess, to differentiate from the invasive common carp, which I think we sometimes forget is an exotic species, arguably our worst exotic species in a lot of ways. But yeah, we're going to have limits on these fish. I doubt very many people were taking anywhere near what these new limits are on these species, but I guess it's better than unlimited, Tim.
I'm just trying to remember the last time Gary Roach wrote an article about quillback carp suckers. You know what I'm saying? I mean, these are not species that are actively targeted or heavily promoted. But, you know, I guess maybe it doesn't hurt to put limits on any species when you think about it, because, you know, guys can go out with their bows and they can literally bang away at certain rough fish like buffalo, or there's the dogfish, which is the bowfin, and it's... I don't remember ever actually catching a limit of dogfish, but I suppose it could be done.
Well, it was unlimited, Tim. And by the way, there is a public comment period on this. This is not locked in yet. If it is approved, it would be effective. Was it March 1, 2027, Tim? So more than a year out. But you know what? You're right. You brought up the bow fishing thing, and I didn't really think about that. There might be some guys that go out and potentially take 30 quillback carp suckers or 30 bigmouth buffalo with their bows during a session. That would seem to be a lot. But those might be some of the guys impacted like by this. Almost all these limits are at 30, except for bowfin, which is 6. And you and I were chuckling off air. Who's ever heard of anybody taking 6 bowfin in a day? Who's ever heard of anybody, you know, even keeping 1 bowfin? But maybe these bow fishermen are the guys that are going to be impacted by this.
Yeah, I can't remember the last time I caught a red horse. You know, I mean, I just don't even remember what they looked like. But, you know, if you're out there targeting red horse, know that now you better pay attention to the regulations, because you don't want to get busted.
Now, Tim, there are absolutely guys in the spring that go out and fish red horse in the rivers.
I bet there is.
I believe they can them, don't they?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I'm laughing because I think it's hilarious that, you know, they're putting limits on these fish that they consider rough fish. There's probably a gillion of them in the system. Maybe not. Maybe that's why they're putting the limits on them. But it is kind of funny from my end.
There's definitely been a movement to apply a little bit of respect to these species. You know, they do have a place out there. There's been studies, especially on like bigmouth buffalo and smallmouth buffalo, that some of these fish are really old, 30, 40, 50 years old. And Tim, I used to go out with commercial fishermen when I was a kid on the river, and, you know, we caught a ton of carp, and they were always nasty, but I've had buffalo smoked for sure, and it's very good. It's firm and a lighter meat, much better than carp, and generally it's a little more valuable to commercial fishermen. And it's a native species. I think we need to circle back on that. Everybody assumes that, you know, rough fish are rough fish, whether they're carp, buffalo, suckers, or whatever, and they're not. Common carp is a damaging, invasive species, whereas these other native so-called rough fish, they've got their place out there.
I just put a note here that this afternoon I am going to go online. I'm going to look up what every one of these fish look like, just so I can refresh my memory. I'm sure I've probably caught one or two, you know, through my long, illustrious angling career, but I don't know. I can't even remember what some of these things look like.
The public comment period on this runs until the end of the day on Thursday, March 12th. Check out this week's print edition of Outdoor News if you want more details on how you can comment on it. Before we go, Tim, we had Dave Zentner, the old war horse from Duluth. He is working with Dennis Anderson and Jim Cox and some other people to put together the Duck Summit. This is going to be in late March down in Nicolet. Dennis has been writing about this. It's something we support here at Outdoor News. We need to do what we can to help the ducks and talk about duck numbers and what we're going to do to improve duck hunting here in Minnesota. And Dave trying to generate a crowd for that event.
Yeah, whenever you're talking about a migrant species, something that migrates like this, you have to realize that it's all about habitat. Why do we have so many ducks? Well, on the Mississippi Flyway and the Dakotas, it's because there's good habitat for them during their transitional periods. And that's what Minnesota needs. Minnesota needs habitat if they're going to have ducks. And something like this Duck Summit is where someone can go and literally educate themselves about what needs to be done. And they can also get their 2 cents in with what they feel needs to be done from their standpoint to create more ducks, more duck hunting. As I said earlier in this broadcast, if you have numbers, you're going to sell licenses. They're seeing people not duck hunting as much as they had in the past, and that's because the numbers have dropped. We need to get those numbers back up if we're going to see people out there taking advantage of this sport. And I think duck summits like this one that they're going to hold on March 27th, which is a Saturday, so you have no excuse for not going, is something that needs to be done so that we can see an improvement in duck hunting numbers.
Yeah, more details in the commentary, this week's print version of Outdoor News and OutdoorNews.com. Well, Tim, thank you for spending a couple seconds with me. Good luck the week ahead. We'll talk to you in 7 days.
We'll catch up to you soon.
Yeah, that's our buddy Tim Lesmeister. Thank you to him, all of our other guests. I hope you all have a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Dreisline. Stay warm. This has been Outdoor News Radio. Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.